My pleasure to ask Brother John to speak to us. When will the River Euphrates dry up?
Perhaps, brothers and sisters, I ought just to explain where that theme title came from. It's just really putting together a sequence of quotes from, of course, the Gospel of John. You remember how when Jesus spoke to his disciples, he told them, John 16, Behold, but these things have I told you, that when the time come, you might remember that I told you. That's why I'm telling you. So that when they come to pass, you might remember that I told you. Interesting thing is, if you work your way backwards from John 16 to John 14, you come across some very similar words. And now, I have told you before it come to pass, so that when it come to pass, ye might believe. A curious thing is, again, if you turn backwards to chapter 13, now I tell you before it come, that when it is come to pass, ye may believe. What? Well, all sorts of things, of course, if you look at those contexts. But we end up back in the second chapter, verse 22. When therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scripture, the word which Jesus had said. So Jesus found it very convenient to tell them what was coming to pass. We could say he gave them the word of prophecy. Why? So that when these things come to pass, they may remember, the Lord told us that, and believe. And of course, many of the reasons that have been given for the study of prophecy, we could think of many reasons. But to me, so often these words come back. We see something happening, and then we say, oh, now where does it say in the Bible a bit about that? You know, this is a sort of phrase, isn't it, we use. And when it comes to pass, like the great events in Europe today, the role of Britain today, we might remember what the Lord has said, the word of prophecy, and thereby believe. And it's my personal belief, as we shall show in a moment, that this use of prophecy and the proclamation of the gospel tends to be falling out of style. Now, why out of the many examples that we could have gone to have we selected these two this afternoon? Drying up of the River Euphrates is, if I may use that phrase, something of a golden oldie amongst us, isn't it? It's a subject which so many of those of us who've been in the truth a number of years are very familiar with. But brothers and sisters, may I ask your indulgence, particularly the older ones, you may know this story backwards, but there is growing up in our midst a generation of younger brethren and sisters, and not just young in age, but newer brethren and sisters, who may not be familiar with the things we were so systematically taught. So I thought we could go back with some profit and look at a very important sign of, if you like, the days of our forebears. And also thereby, hopefully persuade you that it's not a subject that is out of date, but is indeed one that's right up to date. Not often, actually, that Revelation is a subject of a Saturday afternoon fraternal, is it? If you go back and look at the last 20 or 30 fraternal gathering invitations, I think you'd probably agree with me that Revelation doesn't get much of a look in. No wonder, sadly, we come across brothers and sisters who say, the book of Revelation is a closed book to me. Well, let's open the book of Revelation this afternoon. The second subject I'll explain when we get there, but it arises from a very enigmatic little prophecy that has defeated my understanding for some 40 or 50 years and really only struck me when we were on holiday in Cyprus recently. But more about that later. Let's go back to the book of Revelation, the book that sometimes we don't give enough attention to, and ask ourselves, who wrote it? Well, it was John. Where was he? On the island of Patmos. Yes, but what was the view that he had of the world in his time? And the view that John had was that of the Roman Empire. And so this was the context then in which the book of Revelation was written. Well, to whom is it written? It is perfectly acceptable to say it's a coded message to brothers and sisters, for verily it is, but could we be a little more specific? To whom was John addressing his comments? that's going to have to follow me around. To whom was he addressing his comments? Well, stop and think about it for a moment, brothers and sisters. With Jerusalem destroyed and the Jews dispersed worldwide, to whom could John address his last message of Jesus? That of Jesus to his servants. Well, the answer is so obviously simple that you wonder why we don't make more of it. It's to Christians living in the Roman Empire, including those places which have been named earlier in the New Testament, places like Turkey, of course, Yugoslavia, very topical. I mean, you know the three references to Yugoslavia, don't you, in the New Testament? You don't? Oh, well, we haven't got time. There are three. Right there in the news today, brothers and sisters. Greece, Italy, Spain, North Africa, and onwards towards Europe. That being so, that John is talking to brothers and sisters in the context of their day, the Roman Empire, it really isn't surprising that much of Revelation is concerned with God's judgment on Rome in its many forms. If you stop and think about it for a moment, it was Rome that crucified, politically, if you like, Christ and persecuted Christians. It perverted Christianity and sought secular power through its many forms of Christianity. So, it's so obvious, isn't it, that Revelation is addressed to Christians, originally in the context of the Roman Empire, but all down the ages, the context of the Roman Empire in its many forms. Now, it's quite impossible to attempt any layout or explanation of the layout of the book of Revelation, so forgive me for putting this on the screen. I know you can't read it, but you may be able to see the little swathes of colour. This is taken from the testimony a couple of years ago and provides an overview of the book of the Apocalypse. And what I want you to see is just these three chunks of colour to note the way in which there are a discussion of three seals, as they're called, in the front part of the book of Revelation. Then come the trumpets, judgments of God, and then come vials. Now down here is of course a reference to all the other things that we see in the book of Revelation. Now the point I want to make is that the seals, the early chapters, have to do with the internal events of the Roman Empire. By the time we pass on in history to another aspect of the Roman Empire, we note that those sections, those chapters that deal with what are called the trumpets, deal with the western part of the Roman Empire or the eastern part. And then as Rome metamorphoses, takes on a different shape, looks rather differently, the Bible comes back towards the back end of Revelation, dealing with, in chapter 16, which we'll look at, the seven vials. And again, these are judgments upon a different form or different manifestation of Rome. Now, if you just look, please, at the eighth and ninth chapters of Revelation, you'll see something that, this is just marked up the key points in my Bible, but all I want you to do is look down Revelation 8 and 9, and as you do so, you'll see verse 7, there's a reference to the first angel, verse 8 to the second, verse 10 to the third, verse 12 to the fourth angel, and then you come to chapter 9 and it says, and the fifth angel did thus and so, and then you pass on to the sixth angel in verse 13. Now, that's how it looks in the text of my Bible. In fact, it doesn't, because all the margins are used up reminding me what they're about. So let me just tell you then that the basic purpose of the trumpets, what was the purpose of those judgments of God? Well, it was to dispose of the old Roman Empire. So Revelation 8 and 9, you could say in a manner of speaking, is that passage of history where the Lord says the time has now come for that form of the Roman Empire to pass off. And so he sends the marauding hordes, interestingly down from Europe for the most part, Central and Eastern Europe, Alaric leading the Goths, then came the Vandals, then came the Huns under Attila, and then came around about 476 the collapse of Western Rome, that's the Italian peninsula and the European end. Then arose the time of what was called the fifth trumpet, the Saracens.
I hate to call Muslims or Arabs, not a useful term. But they spread, as we shall see in a moment, out through Africa and Spain and into France. And then came finally the Ottomans in the year 1062. And really you could say that between them they saw off the Roman Empire. I've just taken this illustration from Revelation 9. Look at Revelation 9, if you would, verse 7 and 8. And you have this very picturesque description of them, how this horde came forth, the Saracens. This actually was a picture taken, we only use it to illustrate the dramatic way in which their terms are used. These people had, where is it, hair as the hair of women, they had turbans as it were, their teeth were as teeth of lions, they had breastplates, breastplates of iron. The sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. And that was, I think, a picture designed to promote the film Lawrence of Arabia. But it gives us a picture, doesn't it, of a great horde of horsemen arising and coming across the North African desert from Arabia up into Spain. And when people talk about going on holiday to the Algarve, of course, what is that? That's a Saracenic word, if you like, an Arabic word. What does it mean? It means the garden. And what is the leading, if you like, monument to the Saracens in Spain? Why, it's the Alhambra. And they brought with them alchemistry and algebra. These are all words, brothers and sisters, that remind us of that trumpet period. And that fifth trumpet then shows how the Saracens came up, I hope you can see that, northwards into France. And they came as far as Tours, or, as I turned off the M1, came up the A508, I was delighted to see that Northampton is twinned with Poitiers. And that's as far as the Saracens got. Quite an interesting and timely reminder that they came as far, brothers and sisters, as an hour's drive from the Channel ports. Well then, just moving on very quickly, as we want to, we come to the ninth chapter of Revelation, and there I want you to look at verse 13, 14 and 15. And here I'm indebted to a picture I've taken from the Bible Student magazine by Jeff and Ray Walker. But it usefully portrays what we read about this sixth trumpet. Now the sixth set of judgments against what was left of the old Roman Empire comes about when the sixth angel sounded. And John heard, incidentally, we talk, don't we, about Revelation being a book of sign and symbol. I don't think that's an adequate description. It's what today the ALS would call a multimedia presentation. He saw, he heard, and he sensed what was going on. It wasn't just a series of visions or pictures laid out. So he heard and experienced the sounding of the sixth angel from the four horns of the golden altar, saying in the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, look, this is what you do. You loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates, and the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, a day, a month, and a year. And I'd like you just to sort of make a note of an hour, a day, a month, and a year. And maybe you just want to skip over it. But the purpose of this vision, this role of the sixth trumpet, was to loose four powers from the far side of the river Euphrates. And what were these powers? Well, you don't have to have a degree in history, brothers and sisters. All you've got to do is go into W.H. Smith, get hold of a little penguin book, and there, Atlas of World History, it tells you what happened around the 11th, 12th, 13th and 14th centuries. How the Seljuks, then the time of Genghis Khan, Timurlane, and eventually the Ottomans, came out from beyond the river Euphrates, shown here in red, and stormed into the land of the Eastern Roman Empire. Now, second after 1066, the time of William the Conqueror, I would guess that 1453 is fairly well known as the year in which Constantinople, Istanbul as it now is called, fell to the onrush of, well, we could call them the Ottomans, or we could call it Islam. You know, people often say, oh, well, John, Where do you account and how do you account for Islam in the Bible then, and Islam? Well, Islam is right there, brothers and sisters. Revelation 9.
And so what we see as a result of the trumpets is the power that then arose to dominate the Middle East. First on the left, the Saracenic power, and then on the east, the Ottomans. And notice how they came right up into Europe. The Ottomans came right to the very gates of Vienna, and the Saracens right there to Poitiers or Tours in northern France. And I don't think it's wrong to say that the early trumpets, having seen off the power of the Italian peninsula, we can say that, in a manner of speaking, the power of Islam succeeded those two legs of the image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And it doesn't quite fit, but I hope I make the point that what came next, after the destruction of the power in Italy and so on by the hordes that came down from Europe, we see in chapters 8 and 9, the next sequence. But before we leave it, go back to chapter 9, verse 15, because I think it's an encouraging detail. Chapter 9, verse 15, you read how there was to come a period of a year, a month, a day, and an hour. Now, I want to take a little time off for a very good purpose. I want to remind you, if you take hold of a little paperback like that, Remarkable Facts of History. It was on the 27th of April, 1062, that the Seljuks crossed the river Euphrates. And a very well documented date is also the 28th of May, 1453, with the final collapse of Constantinople. If ever you go to Istanbul for a holiday or go and have a look around the place, every guidebook will tell you how those tremendous impregnable walls finally fell on the 28th of May, 1453. And you notice it was 390 years, 1 year plus a month. Now, lest you think I'm a mathematician, let me tell you I failed miserably at my matriculation for maths. But what I do have to tell you is a few basic facts about Jewish chronology. There's going to be a lot of discussion already, isn't there, about whether the year 2000 is in fact 2000 years from the birth of Christ, and how people have got the chronology wrong, and how different time periods or different calendars are used by the Arabs, the Chinese, the Hindus, and so on. Well, Jewish chronology saw a day as a year. That's quite easy for us to accept. But working on from that, if that is so, a month was 30 days. They used the lunar calendar. A year was therefore 360 days. Are you with me? That was the way, and that's why they had to tinker with the calendar every now and again to correct it by 5 days. If you continue with your calculating machine, you can see that 1 hour was 1/12 of a 12-hour day. 12-hour days, evening and morning. Therefore, if one day equals 1 year, you with me, then 1/12 equals 1 month. Now let's work it out. What does Revelation 9:15 tell us? It tells us that the period between the emergence of the Ottomans and the fall of Constantinople was 360 plus 30 plus 1 plus a month, 391 years and a month, and that was exactly the time taken to overcome Istanbul or Constantinople. So over, and this is the point, over 1350 years after the prophecy was given, Constantinople fell to the Ottomans exactly on schedule. 1350 years later, what the Lord had said through John was going to happen, happened exactly on time. What's the value of that to us? Well, it proves to us, doesn't it,
that the Lord has not forgotten his prophecies, and if we can say he's done that exactly on time, what about the rest of the prophecy concerning the River Euphrates? Surely it should give us some confidence that what the Lord has said for part two will duly come to pass. So then, in due course came the Ottoman Empire, which lay like a dead blanket, as it were, right across the Middle East. The Lord has said the time has not yet come for Christ to return. As much has got to happen in Europe. And so the Ottoman Empire prevailed from 1453 right through to this century. Indeed, you know, we used to talk about the Ottoman Empire as though it had always been dried up. As I want to show you, it isn't. What is important, however, was when the truth was first preached in Northampton, I guess, we have to ask a question. What kind of Bible Christian was it, brothers and sisters, who proclaimed the hope of Israel when the Middle East looked like that? What sort of person would dare to stand up and say, well, I believe actually that in the return of Christ, but before he comes, there must be a partial return of the Jews, the establishment of a nominal Jewish state. The man in the street would say, you must be crazy. The Ottoman Empire's been there for 500 years, and you want me to believe that that has got to happen, that this has got to crumble? Why, this is the most impregnable, long-lasting empire since the days of, long before Christ. But the Lord had said it would happen. The word of prophecy was interpreted correctly and believed. And so the Christadelphians of 100 years ago preached and believe passionately that this empire must go to make way for the coming of Christ. But that wasn't all. We're familiar with that. Try and imagine a map of Europe and what life was really like in what I've called the early mid-1800s. Here were Bible-based or Bible students, Christadelphians, proclaiming the time of an independent Israel. You can't be serious. And a united Europe. What? With Europe looking like this? With dozens and dozens of independent little colonies, and you want me to believe from the Bible that this has got to be united? The Ottoman Empire has got to go? And the very powerful Pope, who actually had secular power over chunks of Italy, Papal States, they will disappear? And this troublesome France that had caused that awful revolution was in fact going somehow to be influential in Europe. You see the situation. See how faith and understanding of prophecy enabled our early brothers and sisters to look at Europe and say, well, the word of prophecy makes it clear that there is going to be a united Europe, that there is going to be a departure of the Ottoman Empire, that the secular power of the papal states must depart. And what enabled them to say it? Was it a perception of political geography or some hotline to the foreign ministries in Europe? No, brothers and sisters, it was simply the word of God. And so then, eventually, as we know, the states of Europe did unite unto the Holy Roman Empire, which was... Oh, I know what Voltaire said. He wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, it was an empire. Very clever thing to say. But it did just last from the time of Charlemagne for 1,000 years. So if one wants to be like Voltaire, somewhat dismissive of this organisation, let's face it, it was there until the time of Napoleon. Nay, really, it was still around until the beginning of this century. So the Holy Roman Empire becomes the next phase of the Roman Empire. And this is where I want Brother Williams to lead us now in the reading of Revelation chapter 16. Because it now, in God's unfolding of Bible prophecy, becomes the target of the first five vials of Revelation 16. Show you what they look like, brothers and sisters. We haven't got time to study them all, but perhaps, Brother Williams, you could now read that chapter for us. Well, that's section for us.
That's 16 verses.
1 to 12.
1 to 12. Revelation chapter 16, verses 1 to 12. And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, "Go your ways and pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth." and the first went, and poured out his vial upon the earth. And there fell a noisome and grievous sore upon the men which had the mark of the beast, and upon them which worshipped his image. And the second angel poured out his vial upon the sea, and he became as the blood of a dead man, and every living soul died in the sea. And the third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers and fountains of waters, and they became blood. And I heard the angel of the waters say, Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art, and wast, and shall be, because thou hast judged thus. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy. And I heard another out of the altar say, Even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments. And the fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun, and power was given unto him to scorch men with fire. And men were scorched with great heat, and blasphemed the name of God, which hath power over these plagues. And they repented not to give him glory. And the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast, and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain, and blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and repented not of their deeds. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared.
I suppose he who tries to deal with all those vials in one evening is almost reckless, but I came across what I do not believe is a Christadelphian illustration of the chapter. It's helpful. I don't think it's a Christadelphian. I have no idea where I got it from, I might say. But it tries to just give you a rundown on what the 16th chapter is about. And as you've seen, there are six vials, and we stop reading here. The reason is because the seventh vial is yet future, and is not our subject. It's a passage of Revelation 16 and the book of Revelation that comes into play after the return of Christ, after the time of Armageddon. But if you have a look down your text there, you'll see that the first five vials, and here I'm going to ask you to take my words for it, start off with a judgment upon France, the time of the French Revolution. And there's an irony here in that the power that first gave rise, if you like, in a, I think we could say this, gave rise to the Holy Roman Empire, now became the agent to see it off the scene. Remember what I said? Really, it was the power of Islam, the Saracens and the Ottomans, who saw off the phase of the Roman Empire and took over the next phase. Well, now God selected another human agent. We shouldn't have any problem with this, brothers and sisters, because we all accept, don't we, how Sennacherib was raised up for a particular purpose, how Nebuchadnezzar was raised up by God for a particular purpose, how Cyrus was raised up by God for a particular purpose. Well, that doesn't tell us in as many words. We all accept, if you've ever been to Rome and been through the Arch of Titus, you know that Titus was raised up for a particular purpose of God. So it shouldn't come, therefore, as any difficulty to learn that the Lord picked on Napoleon, that great leader of Western Europe, to fulfill his purpose, which was to dispose of that phase of the Roman Empire. And as you look down, you will see how we come to a time of the battles in Europe between, if we can just see this, a little difficult to see it off the screen there, a time of the struggles, great naval battles, the time of Trafalgar. Incidentally, it's very interesting that Napoleon was very successful in doing what the Lord had commanded him to do. All the time he fulfilled and kept his eye on that purpose, which was to remove that aspect of the Roman Empire. When he dilly-dallied on the way and took on the British Protestants, he came unstuck. Battle of Trafalgar, Battle of Waterloo. When he took on the Eastern Orthodox Church of Russia, well, you know more about the 1812 overture and the disaster that Napoleon suffered there. So when Napoleon did what God wanted him to do, inevitably he succeeded. When he deviated from that purpose, consistently he came unstuck. It is just an interesting comment. When he ventured into Palestine, he was rebuffed. And so the papal states trembled at his power. And we come on to the end of the Holy Roman Empire, the invasion of the papal states, the end of the Holy Roman Empire. When was it? On August 1806, the Emperor of France in Austria turned round and said, in effect, to Napoleon, okay, the game's up. I surrender the Holy Roman Empire to you. And Napoleon, more or less, and if you go to Vienna, of course, you can see a great statue to this effect at the in the Amhofplatz. And so Napoleon saw off the power of the Holy Roman Empire in Europe. And then we come to verse 12. Well, what does it say? The sixth angel turns its attention to the east. The previous five were concerned with, if you like, Western Europe. And we read chapter 16, verse 12, how the sixth angel said, the time is up now for this power represented by the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up. Well, now, those of us who've been around a year or two are fully familiar with the way in which waters and seas are used in the Bible as symbols of people and nations. There may be some who are not persuaded, so let me just take time off to remind ourselves how Isaiah chapter 8 verse 7 says, now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and he shall come over all his channels and go over all his banks. How can a nation do that? A river can. A matter of fact, it's quite interesting how Assyria came to its end. It was actually with the flooding of the Tigris. But did the Tigris overflow and come all the way down to Israel? No, it's a figure of speech, isn't it? Jeremiah tells us, the sea has come up upon Babylon, which is not bad going when you consider how far inland Babylon is from the Persian Gulf. It's physically impossible, isn't it? She is covered with a multitude of waves thereof. How can you have a multitude of waves in the desert? You know where Babylon is. It's been there in all the troubles in the Gulf with Saddam Hussein. Isaiah reminds us that the wicked are like a troubled sea, and when it cannot rest, the waters cast up mire and dirt. And Revelation's quite explicit. The waters are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So then, the drying up of the river Euphrates, scripturally, using scriptural principles, has to do with the recession of that power that the Lord sent forth under the sixth trumpet. Well, now, you never hear this thing talked about outside Christadelphian circles, do you? Well, the idea pre-existed Christadelphia by many years. And I think it's remarkable when you look back to 1643 how Bible students then were looking for the drying up of the River Euphrates. The River Euphrates, said Mr. Mead, we interpret to mean Turkey. So that idea has been around 350 years. Therefore, by the sixth vial this power shall be dried up. 1670, non-Christadelphian Bible student writes, by the great river Euphrates we are to understand the Ottoman Empire. It's called the great river because the multitude of peoples and nations therein. Use of scripture to interpret prophecy. Now here's interesting. Here's a book, 1701. Actually this is a reprint. But when you read what Robert Fleming had to say, it's absolutely amazing, brother and sister, how he, by his use of the book of Revelation, was able to see French Revolution, many other things. But he wrote that the sixth vial will be poured out on the Mahometan Antichrist. He got a bit wrong there on the Antichrist, never mind. Seeing the sixth trumpet brought the Turks from beyond the river Euphrates, the sixth vial dries up their waves and exhausts their power. Bishop Newton, a remarkable man, if ever you read that book on the Dissertation of the Prophecies, which I've got at home, about the time of the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the Jews will turn to the Lord. Amazing. And if the sick vial is poured out on the river Euphrates, it is to be understood as preparing for the return of the Jews. And when these great events come to pass, that is, the return of the Jews and the ruin of the Ottoman Empire, we can expect exciting things. But what Brother Thomas did was see all of those things, not as academic studies of history, but was able to relate them to the covenants of promise, the hope of Israel, the return of Christ to establish the kingdom of God on earth. But he had a very sound history, if you like, and background of many others who could see that prior to the return of Christ, there had to be that decline of the Ottoman Empire. And that was a decline that started around about 1700. Brothers and sisters, you heard Robin Cook refer to the problems in the Balkans this morning on the radio. You see how gradually the power of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, began to crumble, and these states became, in a manner of speaking, either semi-independent or were taken over by other nations. And this is a map, of course, I'm sure we all know from the Apocalypse and History by Bolton and Barker. But it reminds us of how things were beginning to happen. You remember we said, what kind of Bible Christian was it who was prepared to stand up in Northampton Market Square and talk about the return of Christ to re-establish nation of Israel in Palestine when the Middle East looked like that? We can imagine how people got excited, brothers and sisters, when they saw it begin to happen. And this is the point. When that began to happen in the late 19th century, and it was really from the time of the revolt of the Greeks in 1820, when all these Balkan problems, which we're reminded, what's Kosovo about in Serbia? Why, it's about the struggle of Islam versus Greek Orthodox or Roman Catholicism under a different name. It's the struggle between, quote, Christianity and Islam. But when brothers and sisters began to see that happen, they got excited. Here's a couple of booklets I've got at home. Can't bring them because they're nearly falling apart. There's one there that's over 100 years old. And what is it? It's about a lecture given in the Masonic Hall, Birmingham, about the coming dissolution of the Turkish Empire. And that didn't happen for another, 25 years or more. Here's another one. The disintegration of the Turkish Empire, the passing of a once great power. And all I'm trying to say is, when these signs were there, staring brethren and sisters in the face, they used them to proclaim the gospel. Glad tidings, 1908. I hope I'm not overmaking the point that glad tidings from 1908 saw the drying up of the river Euphrates, or the shrinking of Turkey, as something that indicated the nearness of Christ's return. What was it Jesus said? I'm telling you this so that when they happen, you will remember, and fulfilled prophecy will help you to believe. Just in passing, sad really that so many of us are reluctant to use the word of prophecy for preaching the gospel, but not all are. The drying up of the river Euphrates, brothers and sisters, is a vital factor of our own life. But let's go back to where we were, beginning of this century, when Europe looked roughly like that at the outbreak of the World War. You know the situation, how the Austro-Hungarian power, Germany and Austria, were fighting against Britain and France. Russia was involved till the communists came on board, and it suited Turks, who saw the collapse of their empire, Serbia, Montenegro, Kosovo. They saw that collapse coming, and so the Turks decided to side up, obviously in the providence of God, with Germany. And they became what is known as the Axis powers. They had an axis right across Europe. And you know the rest of the story, don't you? How in God's good time, Turkey had to pass off the scene. That great Turkish empire from east of the river Euphrates had been collapsing naturally, and now came the major advance of Britain into Europe. And last year we spent an awful lot of time, didn't we, testifying how on the 50th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel, we reminded ourselves how the Balfour Declaration.
Now, could you imagine Robin Cook doing this sort of thing today, Rare Sisters? Doesn't it show you the tremendous and dramatic change in the role of Tarshish that has taken place? But Balfour, the then Foreign Minister, writes,
and Balfour, by the way, it is said, did his readings in his office at the Foreign Office every day and had a reading plan on his desk. I've often wondered what that reading plan was. But His Majesty's Government, well, you know it, don't you? The Balfour Declaration, which led to the creation of a national home for the Jews.
But God isn't in a rush, brothers and sisters. When that happened, why did the Lord tell us?
Because when you see it happen, you'll remember. We're not in the prediction business. We're not here predicting what the Lord will do next. You'll remember. And it caused many to believe. I, for one, was one who believed and was baptized when I saw what I thought at the time was the final and ultimate fulfillment of Ezekiel 37. That was 50 years ago, and boy, wasn't I wrong.
Israel now existed. And when we think of our brethren of 150 years ago, following what was happening, in their day it was Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. In my day it was the State of Israel.
And that recording brother of the Oxford Ecclesia who wrote hymn 219, is it? The days are swiftly flying. Remember the last words? Now is our faith turned to sight.
We live then in the days when we can see, we can remember, and we can believe.
But how does Revelation 16 verse 12 continue? Have a look. The power represented by the River Euphrates was to dry up. Why? Well, so as to facilitate the start of the return of the Jews to the land. That would facilitate the return of Christ, the resurrection and judgment of the saints. Judgment must begin at the household, brothers and sisters, before it can begin on the nations. It's a pity we've somehow got those in the wrong sequence. We somehow think there's going to come the judgment upon the nations and the nations round about before the time of judgment on of the saints of the household. But the drying up of the River Euphrates was intended to prepare, as you read, verse 12, the way of the kings of the east. And who are they? Who are the kings of the east? Very, very difficult passage to explain, really. Acres have been written on the subject. Lots of guesses have been made. I can remember some years ago, in fact it was just after the war, when there were brethren who said, certainly in the ecclesia where I was, oh, well, this could be the rise of the Chinese, you know. The Japanese have come on scene during the First World War, and the kings of the east could mean that, like Genghis Khan came over from the Euphrates, it could be the Japanese. About 20 years later came those who, misunderstanding Psalm 83, saw it as the rise of the Arabs, a total misapplication of scripture. But nonetheless, it was one of the ideas. And then if you read the NIV, it talks about that and interprets that passage as being the rise of the Parthian kings. Actually, that's not a bad guess, because it refers in the end to Iran. And certainly, as we shall see, Persia or Iran will have a great presence in the last days. So how are we to understand it?
Well, as I said, there are many, many ways of explaining it. And we want to try and keep it as simple as we can. Now, I'm no Greek scholar, I know no Greek or Hebrew. I pride myself on merely average common sense. I can understand, however, that in the original Greek, the word for kings of the east, Anatol Helios, represents kings of the sun's rising. And you might well say, well, what's the difference between that and the kings of the east? The emphatic dialogue, which, as you know, was written by a companion of Brother Thomas, often not known, before he went off on his own, and the dialogue copyright now, as you know, is owned by the Jehovah's Witnesses. But that reads, the way of the kings of the rising of the sun. Again, you say, well, wait a minute, that's in the east, isn't it? The 1881 RV says, the way for the kings that come from the sun's rising. Rotherham
talks about the kings from the rising of the sun. And you say, yes, John, but that still means in the east. Well, yes, but what is in the east? Well, it's where the sun rises. And so we have to try and understand it. Now, I'm not going to go into the complications of the Greek language, but I'll tell you how I read it. Forgive me if you think it's oversimplification. Malachi, last chapter of the Old Testament, tells us that we look forward to the return of Christ, who is the risen Sun, S-U-N, of righteousness. Who will be Christ at his coming? The answer is the saints. Yes. Well, what does the New Testament of Peter tell us the saints will be? Well, they will be kings and priests. Yes, no argument with that. By whom will they be raised? Well, they will be risen by the Son of Righteousness to meet the judgment of Christ. Well, you could then say they are kings and priests, kings of their sons rising. You may not, certainly some of the older ones, may not feel that's a very adequate explanation, but I hope it makes the point that when the Jews returned to their land, it created a nominal state of Israel, thereby, as Isaiah 40 tells us, preparing the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our mind. So then, the river Euphrates had to dry up, had to evacuate from Israel, which it has done, so that the Jews could go back, patronised and pushed and sponsored by Britain and others, so that eventually there would be a place for the Lord to return with the saints. Which you might say is all well and good, but John, hang on, Turkey still exists, hasn't dried up, has it? And that's something, you know, that's always puzzled me, because when I was brought up in the truth, people used to say, oh, well, the drying up of the river Euphrates has dried up all except for this little bit over here, and thus the prophecy is fulfilled. I don't believe that. I'll tell you why I don't. Do remember that when the powers under the sixth trumpet came into Turkey, what did they do? They drove out the quotes, Christians, the Christian Caesars, northwards. So remember that they were driven out of Constantinople by the Islamic invaders of the sixth trumpet in 1453. Just seen that. The Tsars of Russia, who were formerly known as the Caesars of the old Eastern Empire, have always intended to return. Again, you only have to read a few simple paperbacks to realise that when the Christians, falsely so-called, were kicked out of Istanbul, the Caesars went northwards, took the title Caesar with them, except in Russian it's called a Tsar, and they've always intended to return. I think I might have shown this last time I came to Northampton, but Sheila and I were able to go to Moscow a little while back. And when we did, we stood in the centre of the Kremlin, inside the Kremlin, looking at these onion dome churches and looking at these crosses on the top. And I stood there, I looked at these crosses and thought, well, they're unusual, they're very ornate. And I said to the tourist guide, and that was an official Russian government tourist guide, look, this is rather strange. What are those little crescents there? Perhaps they show up better in black and white. Under each of those crosses is a crescent. Maybe we can enlarge that a little bit. You see? And I said, that's rather strange. Don't see them like that in the West. And this lady turned around to me almost with a sense of disgust and said, but don't you realise where we came from? That's a well, you know, you tell me. He said, well, we came from Istanbul. That's where the original Tsars came from. And ever since the time of Catherine the Great, who tried, you know, remember, to go back into the Ukraine, Russia's wanting to get back there. And that, Mr. Ramsden, is just a reminder to us all of the time when, once again, Christianity will prevail against Islam, and it's there in all our churches. Well, I thought that's quite interesting. But, of course, what we do know is, speaking of Russia in the last days, what does Ezekiel say? Chapter 38, verse 16. Thou shalt come. This is the interiorist guy had no knowledge of this sort of thing. It was just a Russian ambition described in Ezekiel, the time when thou shalt come against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land that the heathen may know when I shall be sanctified in thee, O God. And so then we are observing, are we not, and looking for a new latter-day power to arise in the north. Don't know who it'll be. Well, Yeltsin's been let out of hospital, so it's a bit of a cliffhanger, isn't it? When he goes, who takes over? We don't know. We're not in the prediction business, brothers and sisters. We're in the business of watching, and when we see it happen, remembering and telling our friends that this is but the fulfillment of prophecy. So, when the latter-day power in the north is to come down onto the Holy Land, what stands in its way? Turkey. The great barrier between Russia in the north and the land of Israel in the south is Turkey. And Turkey still exists. And it's 98% Islamic and has some big problems. So we ask ourselves, well, is Turkey going to be a complete barrier to Russia's progress? No. How will Turkey and Russia get together? Might it be voluntarily by some alliance? Might it be by Russian aggression? Might it arise from the current conflict with which Greece finds itself in conflict with Turkey over Cyprus? Might some third power decide to intervene? But when you read the papers over the last year or two, brothers and sisters, there has been a constant stream of speculation. Will the Red Armies of Russia rush in where NATO fear to tread? NATO have got to keep on side with Turkey because it wants that air base in Incirlik with which to attack Saddam Hussein. Moscow involved in Turkey's need for oil, Soviet-Turkish summit to fit the seal of friendship pact, anti-West feeling growing against Turkey. Oh, it's amazing when you keep your eyes open and just watch. What's going on in the press? What do you find? Turkey ready to turn its back on the European Union. Turkish jets in Cyprus as a warning to Greece. Missiles heighten the Cyprus tension. But as we shall show you next, Cyprus, Russia's encounter with Tarshish and her stepping stone to doom. When that happens, brothers and sisters, when Russia does move southwards, only and only when Russia re-establishes herself once again in Istanbul will the Euphrates be dried up and the image of Nebuchadnezzar be in a position, metaphorically speaking, for a stone to smite it upon its feet. Has the River Euphrates dried up? No, I don't think it has. When will it? I don't know. But it will. And when it does, it will see the re-establishment of Daniel chapter 2.